Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Do you like a little variety in your musical selections? If so, today is your day on Triad Arts Weekend. We begin with fiddler and banjo artist Rex McGee and his band. They've got 13 doses of musical medicine that's the genuine article. Their new CD, Cripple Crunk, renews vigor, provides immediate relief, and all but guarantees a cure for all that ails you. Renowned international piano soloist Joel Fan is here to share his revelations about music, interpretation, and his longtime mentor, the late great American composer Leon Kirchner. Arts-based school students are finding a whole world of meaning in a simple Czech folktale. Brundibar, the tale-turned opera first performed by children in a Nazi-run concentration camp, is coming to the Triad. Arts director Mary Siebert and student actors Bella Hart Peck and Ellie Simpson Burdett are here with more. And more music rounds out the show with versatile guitarist Larry Davis and a special memorial concert next after this news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. When I think about recording an album these days, images of lots of headphones and individual musicians recording in his or her own small isolation booth spring to mind. There are usually lots of takes and overdubs to make for a nice, slick, perfect package. Well, that vision gets thrown out the window with my first guest today, Cripple Crunk. Cripple Crunk is the band and the name of their new album, recorded live in one room in a semicircle to recreate that feel of a jam session. Like a jam session, there were no opportunities for overdubs, and what you hear is what you get. Great spontaneous music making by some of the country's finest fiddlers, pickers, and cajonists. That's longtime drummer percussionist Bobby Martin, who plays the cajon, a Peruvian percussion instrument, on the album. The recording project was led by Winston-Salem-born banjo player Rex McGee, who composed and arranged the music. Rex is a real musician's musician whose reputation extends to fiddle and guitar as well. His playing and compositions have been featured on mandolinist Tony Williamson's Grammy-nominated Sessions at McBain Mill, and his tours with flat-picking guitarist legend Larry Keel and renowned Newgrass vocalist John Cowan led to collaborations with Vassar Clements and Tony Rice, among others. The friends who form Cripple Crunk share a love for traditional Appalachian string band music, but they also share a passion for a huge variety of styles. Many of those styles find their way onto the 13 tracks that make up their remarkable debut recording. You can hear these self-described extreme acoustic instrumentals live in concert in the comfortable confines of the Community Arts Cafe on Friday night, November 8th at 8 o'clock. Rex joined me recently along with bandmates guitarist John Garris and cajon player Bobby Martin. Rex, last we spoke, you told me a little about your connection with this great music, the string band music, and it goes way, way back.
There's a lot of family history. This is humorously referred to it as a family curse. I'm a fiddle player of many generations of McGee fiddle players, and my grandpa was a big influence in making me want to play the fiddle and this kind of music.
Just hearing him play, and you got the itch at what age was it?
I would have had my first violin lessons when I was 4 years old.
Okay.
But the violin lessons weren't what excited me as much as seeing him play the old-time fiddle. And so it probably took till my teenage years before I really gravitated towards his music and really digging in and learning old-time tunes on the fiddle.
Interesting. And Bobby, how about yourself? When did you get involved with percussion?
I was sort of a different case. I was raised in a bluegrass family, bluegrass music from both sides, mom and dad and the family.
Whereabouts, Bobby?
Originally from Salisbury, NC. Uh-huh. Live in Union Grove now. And it was really weird because I traveled a number of years on the road playing country and different things out west and up through Canada.
And drum set?
A drum set. And then I came back to my roots, so to speak, and hooked up with some great musicians, acoustic musicians, and I made a turn towards that acoustic sound.
Well, I want to talk about that acoustic sound in the cajon in just a minute, but first I'm going to turn the mic over to John and get his, entree into this world. I mean, fine picker, and where did it all begin for you, John?
I mostly remember my grandparents playing guitar on my mom's side and some harmonica on my dad's side. Kind of funny, I had a bunch of harmonica players in the family. But
how about that?
Yeah, it's kind of different.
You all are invested in it, and this new album, I mean, it just blew me out of the water. Congratulations.
Thank
for
you.
Starters.
Thank
just
you.
Great tunes.
Thanks.
A lot of original music and just fantastic performances. And you keep that live sound, that kind of like in the moment sound, which I love so much. For the listeners not in the know, tell me about a cajon. What is
cajon?
It?
It's a Peruvian instrument. It's a wood box. It's got different tones that you can bring out and play. And you got your high end, where it would be like a snare, and then your low end would be like a kick.
Yeah.
On a bass drum, and I do a lot of brushwork on the cajon instead of using my hands, because it allows me to get the tones that I want for acoustic music.
Well, and this project really was a perfect vehicle for that, because you all are set up to really capture that live jamming sound. Rex, talk about the dynamic at Mitch Easter's place there at the Fidelitorium, and what was that like for y'all?
We had originally thought about recording this in my living room at home. I was working full-time as a pharmacist and was going to try to squeeze this thing in one weekend of being off. And he, Brent Lambert, immediately, recognized there would be some technical challenges with working in the living room. And he said, you don't do that many things like this. It'll be your first solo release in 13 years. Why not pony up and go to a real studio somewhere? And I said, so he talked me into it. And Mitch's place was on the short list right away. So we went there, and it was a very nice, relaxed vibe. And Brent was very well set up with an impressive array of microphones. And their equipment was very much up to the task of allowing us to just sit around in one room, much like we would around a campfire. In this case, the campfire was the microphone array.
Love that. Mm-hmm. Now that, without doing lots of punch-ins and whatnot, that must add a little pressure to the situation. But, I mean, you handled it well.
That's
but
right.
What was the scene like?
There were no punches. It was just we would do takes, much the way probably things were recorded in the 50s and 60s before a lot of multi-tracking at the end of the day, selected from the best of, four or five takes that we had.
All right.
But I really worked these guys to death for those 2 days, because we tracked 13 tunes, and you can do the math. Four or five takes for each one ends up being about 50-some takes that we amassed in 2 days of work. And
that's a long day.
I'm lucky to be alive after these guys were staring me down.
Well, right off the gate, you get a sense of the excitement of that process with first track on the album, Jesse's Jam Cakes. When you're playing in the studio like that, you're not in front of a campfire. Can you get yourself in that place like we're jamming?
Yeah, once the music starts, then you're there. You're in front of the campfire again. Many ways to approach recording, doing a recording project, and one might be the perfectionist approach, where you're looking for everybody to get that perfect take. And frankly, there are no perfect takes where everybody got every second of every song right on this album. You're going to be able to find misses, hits, and flubs here and there, but more of the focus was capturing that energy of spontaneity.
Yeah.
And the excitement of really playing the music, not just doing a clinical operation where you make sure everything's perfect.
Are they all originals?
Most of these are originals. Now, I will say some of them are more taken from traditional tunes. I think immediately of the song Cripple Creek, which, of course, we named Cripple Crunk. We're trying to do it, trying to keep everything youthful and funny here.
Yeah,
so there's some traditional tunes that we just do some very stylized versions of. I wanted to cover a lot of the influence of a lot of different genres. As we typically did to keep ourselves entertained growing up playing with each other, we wouldn't, I guess, likes gravitate towards likes. And a lot of my friends that I made playing music were people like-minded that wanted to play other styles.
Well, that's a perfect segue into the track two. Just right. I mean, this one, talking about Crunkberry Blossom, you get some funky, crunky grooves on that bad boy. Who are some of your all's crossover influences? Because it really brings it into a different realm.
Yeah, that was an idea of reharmonizing an old fiddle tune. Really, the Crunkberry Blossom, it takes Blackberry Blossom, and we just I added some harmonies and slowed it down, and Bobby's got a funkier groove on the percussion. It's almost a shame for me to claim credit for arranging and composing a lot of this stuff. It's happened in so much as a group effort, but it got enormously complicated if I tried to be completely accurate.
The magic was there. The magic was there.
You could tell. How many times have you heard bands that have tried to be eclectic or tried to embrace different styles? It's seamless on this album. That's what I love it so much.
That's kind of the rule, is you just didn't want to stop that from happening.
Yeah, exactly.
That was kind of the goal, is to make sure that you just didn't step on the toes of the spontaneity part, you know.
Yeah.
And I think what helped that was probably Brent's idea of putting up the large array of mics and stuff like that, and then throwing that into the nice room mix when you're done.
Well, at the heart of it all are great performances, and I guess on this particular tune, talking about Crunkberry Blossom, I love Nate Leith's playing on this. The fiddle solos are, again, kind of in keeping with the whole project, just the variety of sounds he's getting in the thing.
Being a fiddle player myself, fiddle players are notoriously persnickety about other fiddle players, you know, as far as your taste of who you like and who you don't. But Nate really grew up with our school of playing, if there is such a thing, where you've got people that are versatile and able to cross over into different genres. And he was just an amazing prodigy as a young kid, winning Galax Fiddlers Convention when he was, what, like 10 years old?
I knew Nate when he was 7 and 8 years old, and he was a child prodigy then. And we became friends a long time ago.
And once he was old enough to stay up late and after midnight, you know, he learned all the bad habits that these guys do. And he really and went on to a Berklee School of Music there in Boston and became a well-trained musician. And he's probably the most literate of all the guys on the road.
That's funny you mentioned the Berklee thing. I didn't realize. I'm hearing a little Tommy Gerald, and all of a sudden it's Stefan Grappelli. And all, this is the same, or John Blake. It's like the same guy. He's
totally the perfect guy for the project. Nate Leith is
fantastic.
Amazing player.
Privilege working with him.
Love the title, Jig of Retribution, Rome Mountain Grown. And again, speaking of the variety in the album, what are some of the common threads that you need to get right? And you're talking about how persnickety you are as a fiddler, hiring a fiddler. Any of you guys can chime in on this. Yeah, you're doing a whole bunch of different styles of music, but what you got to get right to make it all work as a whole?
I can say, when you sit down with quality musicians that were on this CD, the magic happens.
You could get technical about answering the question, saying that everybody plays with good tone and good timing and the appropriate taste for whatever genre we're in at the moment. But it's also, you could take any one of these genres, and maybe a purist within that genre would say something's a little strange about the way these guys are doing it. But by the time you mix them all together, it's sort of its own sound. And
either
you like it or you don't. But
Jig of Retribution is a great tune, and I love the switch in tempo. That up-tempo
jig-do-a-reel, so that always is a cheat trick that works.
I mean, we're locking the tempo with you there, Bobby, where it shifts into the jig?
Yes.
The reel, from the jig to the reel?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's what I'm talking about. We were, to myself, I was reading off of these guys, you know, because, I mean, the tempos and the changes, it was a good tune to work with.
Thank you. I don't know. I mean, the music's great. The compositions are great. And the titles are great. Can we go back to the letter K and Cripple Crunk?
There we go.
Great tune. And these are all, again, so many of these originals or you know, arrangements by Rex. I love the combination of just the seriousness in terms of the musicality, the you know, the musicianship in this. But there's always lightheartedness in it, and it comes across in this tune. You don't hear trading twos that often in bluegrass, and you get it on this tune. Speak to that, the humor element in some of these things.
Yeah, Danny is quite a humorous fellow, the mandolin guy. My partner Danny nicely goes back to, gosh, us getting in all kinds of musical mischief up at Galax when we were teenagers.
Okay.
And Danny lives in Northern Virginia, and he is a band leader in his own right. He's traveled the world and involved with many different projects. And yeah, he's a funny guy as well, and so it can't help but come out. I really think this idea of, yeah, like you say, trading twos might have came out of a jam session at Galax a couple years ago where we, you know, sometimes you're not in the mood to play it Cripple Creek, like wide open fast, and instead you want to just play a little funky version of it. And so
well, this
we can
is
sit
it.
Here and have a musical conversation, you know, back and forth between two or three of us, you know.
Well, let's hear some of that. It's the perfect ending. I mean, I laughed out loud. My office mate just said, David, are you okay? I'm at his,
the Bo Diddley ending, right?
You got to have that. That's awesome. All right. And that's a Cripple Crunk. That's the title cut, as they say. Cripple Crunk, 13 doses of instrumental musical medicine. I love it. There's one tune that on the album that's got a slow groove on it, and it was real bluesy, talking about TNBABCB. What is that, T?
That is an acronym.
I had a
feeling.
You know
what an acronym that is?
Can we say this on NPR radio?
You can absolutely. Yeah, it's not anything you might would think it would be. It is, there'll never be another Brown County Breakdown, which Brown County Breakdown is a famous Bill Monroe tune that's usually done a lot quicker. It's a breakdown.
Oh,
so we slowed it up and paired it with the great There'll Never Be Another You jazz classic. So we took the changes from a jazz tune and took the melody head from a bluegrass tune, slowed it down, and it's this obscure. And this, I think, was Danny's brainchild, actually. I might have changed his arrangement a little bit, but just one of those freaks of nature.
A lot of fun playing everything with everybody. It's tough when you're dealing with health issues sometimes, but at the same time, it when you get around music like that, it just carries you right through.
Music's the best medicine.
It is.
There it is. And Rex, I can't let you off the hook on that one, because I could have sworn I was, and this is for early on in the playing here, I thought, God, what does this remind? Is it Earl Klug? Is it George Benson? And all of a sudden, you came in with some scat singing on
there
that solo.
Yeah, that's, you just have to feel that sort of thing. You can't plan that moment. See, I thought that was going to be an outtake for sure, and that nobody would have used it. But at the end of the day, again, humor wins. So.
Oh, I don't think Bella Fleck tried that out yet. That's awesome. That's innovative.
He's a smarter man than me.
Oh, come on.
Not always evident to everybody that there's a tune in every key, so there's a little nod to Bach there. If you start, the first tune is in G, and they go all the way up through G sharp. So in chromatic order. So there's a technical detail that's...
A little well-tempered crunk?
A little bit of well-tempered crunk going on.
But hiding some of these things. You can't tell everybody all the secrets.
Yeah, I got it. Well, nobody had ever figured it out otherwise. But then you get to the last tune, and that last tune actually modulates through all 12 keys in that one tune, and also modulates, summarizes a lot of the styles we did in the rest of the tunes on the album. So you've got the melody to a traditional fiddle tune called Did You Ever See the Devil, Uncle Joe, which comes from the Irish repertoire of Miss McLeod's Reel. And we just modulate after it, initially every 32 bars, and then it starts shrinking down near the end where we're modulating every 16 bars and every 18 bars. And so we cover all the keys, and we do it in different styles as we pass through. We play it more bluegrassy, old-timey, Irishy, swing, Cajun, a little R&B. So it's the last tune summarizes the project.
Cripple Crunk is Rex McGee on banjo, John Garris guitar, Danny Nicely mandolin, Nate Leith fiddle, Dennis Lee bass, and Bobby Martin on cajon. My thanks to Bobby, John, and Rex who joined me today. You can hear them live in all their acoustic splendor in the wonderful, intimate setting of the Community Arts Cafe in Winston-Salem, where you can actually hear all the instruments and not leave the concert with your ears ringing. Their performance is Friday night, November 8th at 8 o'clock, and you'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we come back from this short break, it's Mary Siebert and two talented young actors from the Arts-Based School in Winston-Salem. They've got stories to tell, lessons to learn, and a heartwarming song from the opera Brundabar, which they'll share with us live next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. In 1938, Jewish Czech composer Hans Krása began writing an opera for a government competition, but due to political upheaval in Europe, the competition never happened, but the work Brundabar was completed that year. The first performance wasn't until 1942, and by that time, Krása had already been transported to the Theresienstadt concentration camp. By July of the following year, nearly all of the children of the original chorus had been transported to the camp as well. The Arts-Based School in Winston-Salem takes on Krása's remarkable opera based on a simple Czech folktale with two performances on November 20th at 6 o'clock and 7:30 in Hanesbrands Theater. Artistic director Mary Siebert and student actors Bella Hart Peck and Ellie Simpson Burdett join me to talk about the performance. Bella, you're 12, and you've been involved in this stuff for a long time. 5 years old is when you started at Arts?
Yeah, five years old.
Then Arts-Based Elementary, now Arts-Based School. How's your connection with the arts changed over those years?
I've learned a lot about stage presence and a lot about, like, acting and stuff.
Tell me something good about stage presence.
When I was little, it was just about being able to say my lines without stammering. And now, it's about really being able to be my character.
Mm-hmm. Being your character, though, it seems like that's the big challenge for all actors, getting outside of yourself. How do you even begin to do that? What are some steps along the way to get a person in that direction?
Well, what I do is I think of the backstory about my character, and it kind of helps me figure out what they would be acting right now.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, your character in this production is a boy.
Yes.
And first off, any apprehension going into this about being a boy in a play? You're not a boy. You're a girl, a young lady. What's it like as a girl? Was there any apprehension? Like, oh, I got to play a boy. How am I going to do that? That sort of thing.
Well, I've always been a tomboy. Like, I've never been like one of those like really girly girl kind of people, and I have five brothers, and so it kind of helps with the whole trying to be a boy thing.
Five brothers, that'll give you some perspective. Okay. Yeah, I gotcha. You've been involved in Winston-Salem Youth Chorus, great group, performed in musicals, Glee Club, in Carmen, in opera. What sorts of things do these varied experiences give you?
I actually got into Carmen, like Ellie and I got into Carmen by the youth chorus.
Aha. Okay.
And it kind of gives you a perspective of like what I want to like really study on being. Like, do I want to be on stage? Do I want to be in opera? Do I want to be in movies? Like stuff like that.
Yeah. What do you think? Are you leaning anywhere, any particular direction?
I'm leaning towards Broadway.
Why not? Go for it.
Yeah. Broad. I really like the immediate response of the audience.
Nice.
Yeah.
Have you been to Broadway?
No.
Well, you will one day. Ellie Simpson-Burdett is here. Ellie, welcome back. Hey, you're also really active in a whole variety of arts. How's the difference singing and acting versus playing the bass, playing that big old bass? In terms of anything, how's it different?
Well, for example, like the bass, if you don't want to play it anymore, you can just put it down. But like with singing, you'd have that instrument with you for your whole life. And so it's good to learn how to do it well.
Yeah, that is something that singers are often referring to, and just trying to get people to empathize with the gravity of them. And it's you. You have good days and bad days depending on how you're feeling inside.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. And then you're transitioning not only from singing to instrumental work and acting, but also within the realm of music, you transition from classical music and second bass in the Winston-Salem Youth Philharmonic, congratulations, into Dan River Girl work and playing bluegrass and country and all kinds of variety of styles. So what changes in how you play the bass, shifting from one style to the next?
In Scottish music, I usually play with my bow. It's just kind of the style.
Hmm. Do you use a French bow or German bow?
I use a French bow.
Uh-huh.
And in like bluegrass, it's mostly all plucking or pizzicato.
Yeah. How's your callus going? Oh, not so good today. She's got a Band-Aid on her finger. Do you have a favorite tune from Brundabar?
What do you think, Ellie?
I like Shake Up Your Energy.
That one's really fun to sing because it's really like jumpy.
Ah, jumpy. Can we have a little taste?
For sure.
How about just a little? You guys are professionals.
Shake up your energy, fight against gravity. You might be mad at me, that's how it has to be. Sorry, my dear. I'm gonna aggravate until you elevate. Time to participate, though it's unfortunate morning is here.
I don't know.
You guys are good. That's awesome.
Next verse.
Well done. I love it.
Brundabar is a Czech folktale in which the evil organ grinder, Brundabar, denies two little children the opportunity to make music in the town square so they can make money to save their mother, who's sick, buy milk. And so the children team up with three animals who overhear their plight, and the animals organize all the kids in the town to come and sing to earn money. And with all those voices together, they're loud enough that they can overwhelm the sound of the organ grinder. And so they make enough money, chase the organ grinder away, and everybody's okay. Mom is saved.
All right. This is pretty heavy stuff, Mary. What are you hoping the students come away with from this experience?
Well, one thing I like about it is that the story itself can be sung for young children who don't need to learn about the Holocaust yet. For us, the challenge is we're required to teach the Holocaust at seventh grade, and it's nobody wants to do it. We don't want to admit man's inhumanity to man, to children. But I think that this is a beautiful window through which the children can view it, thinking in terms of how it impacted children. And I hope that they come away with a powerful sense of the injustice of it all, and also that we can honor in memory the children who performed this at Terezin.
We've got nothing, not a cent, and poor mommy's sick in bed.
I think the main thing that makes arts-based unique as far as the arts integration goes, if If you listen to the kids talk about how their day is structured, it sounds pretty traditional. They do switch classes and focus on math and then language arts and then science. But all the teachers at every grade level work together with all the arts specialists at that grade level and plan so that they're reinforcing one another's goals and sharing vocabulary.
In this case, does the music then help reinforce a retention of a period in history? How does the history then inform the performance? I mean, that's a kind of a cold, calculated way of breaking it down, but I've always been kind of curious about that balance. In this case, and what have you seen in terms of how one informs the other for the long haul? Like, they're going to leave here, and then years down the road, what sort of feedback have you gotten along those lines?
Well, a couple of things. I think the thing that we do best is a combination of self-confidence, individuality, self-expression. There's a lot of value placed on that in our school, and of problem solving, of creative problem solving. So innovation develops out of your ability to be creative. And so many of the projects that our students do require them to come up with their own answers. And that's what the arts do. With a larger scale project like we're working on with Brindabar, and Brindabar is unique because we don't do, as a general rule, pieces that were composed by somebody else. We put our pieces together, our large scale integrated pieces. Brindabar, though, is a piece that we honor as it was composed. And what I think it will give the kids that will be long lasting is an intimacy with children who survived or did not survive the Holocaust, because they're playing the roles those children played. They're singing the same notes, and they will be learning about some of those individual children through memoirs. And so if you give a kid a couple of chapters in a history book to read about the Holocaust, and they have to memorize facts and answer the questions, it's 18% of those, it said, 18% of the children who learn that way succeed, function at an A level. But if you give them something that requires them to empathetically step into that time period, and the arts require that of them, then they're going to connect with it in a much richer way. And they'll also be attracted to certain aspects of the story that they might not otherwise have investigated. And I think they'll come out of it with a much richer knowledge as a result, not to mention what they gain by doing really quality music and all the research that shows that that helps them develop their brains, the neurological pathways that help them with language arts, and also the mathematical connections that you gain when you do music.
Well, I'm finding out with regard to this project and Brindabar, the first off, just historically, was not aware of concentration camps set up within what is now the Czech Republic, and was not familiar with Hans Krause's music. Who was Hans Krause, and tell me about this music.
Well, I can't tell you a lot about Hans Krause other than he did some smaller works that still survive. His influence was clearly inclusive of Gershwin. You can hear a little American influence, but also you definitely hear German influence. Kurt Weill, for example, in this particular score.
Okay.
And he created this particular opera for a competition. And obviously thought very carefully through orchestration so that when a child's voice is singing, because it was composed for children to sing, when a child's voice is singing, the orchestration becomes very light. And then in between, when there's action, we get the whole 12-piece band. Mm. So he tries not to cover up the voices and create some balance. It's an elegantly composed piece. I don't know whether it would still be done as often as it is had it not been for its historical significance.
Yeah, because unfortunately the piece, the competition aspect of it fell apart. Mm-hmm. A little thing came along called World War II.
Mm-hmm.
From there, the application of the work completely unique. I mean,
yeah. So one of his colleagues, that the librettist was able to was happened to have been in London, I think, at the time that that Crossa was captured and just didn't return to Europe and escaped. But Crossa was Jewish, and he was brought to Terezin, also known as Theresienstadt. And a colleague smuggled in the score to Brindabar into the camp. And as it turns out, the Nazis decided they had a lot of arts-focused people in that camp, and they decided to encourage the arts in that particular concentration camp so they could use the camp as a showpiece. It became propaganda. And so they would invite people to come and see what children were painting and singing and performing. There were musicians playing, small orchestras forming. And so they decided to allow, the Nazis decided to allow Brindabar to be performed in the camp. And it was subsequently performed at least 55 times.
And not just for anyone, the International Red Cross viewed it.
Yeah, I think it was 1944, that the Red Cross came through and the Nazis were showing them how humane these camps were. And they said, nobody from these camps is executed. But the morning that the Red Cross arrived, a train full of people left Terezin to go to Auschwitz so those people could be executed. The camp was cleaned up and brightened up, and the ladies were wearing stockings and carrying handbags, and they were all coached on how to behave so that the Red Cross would think that it was like a happy little city. And the kids did a performance of Brindabar, and the Red Cross reported that it was a nice place, that everybody was being well taken care of. And as soon as they left, the whole cast from Brindabar was sent to Auschwitz. And there were many more casts after that.
Arts-based school artistic director Mary Siebert and student actors Bella Hart Peck and Ellie Simpson Burdett. They'll be teaming up for two performances of Hans Krause's Brindabar on November 20th at 6 o'clock and 7:30 in Haynes Brands Theater. Admission is free, but seating is limited, and you'll need to make reservations by calling the school office. You'll find links at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break now. When we get back, it's time for an up-close and personal conversation with one of today's leading pianists, Mr. Joel Fan. He's coming to the Music Academy of North Carolina in Greensboro, and he joins me next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Next up, it's time for piano. An internationally acclaimed pianist, Joel Fan, is a true master of his instrument. The New York Times says Joel's playing has a, quote, powerful touch and big sound with the sparkle and rhythmic suppleness of a jazz improviser, close quote. Perhaps it should come as no surprise then that Joel's programs encompass a huge variety of musical styles, from Beethoven's triple concerto performances alongside Yo-Yo Ma and Jonathan Gendelsman to Burmell's funk studies for piano. New music is also at the core of much of Joel's performed and recorded work, with several new commissions for piano in the works. Some of Joel's appreciation for composition came from his longtime mentor, the late American composer pianist Leon Kirchner. The Pulitzer Prize-winning composer and his music were at the center of Joel's recent CD, Leon Kirchner Revelations, on Verdant World Records. The reference recordings artist will share some of Kirchner's music along with several other works in an evening recital and reception on Saturday night, November 9th at 7:30 at the Sloan Theater of Greensboro Day School. It's a fundraising concert for the Music Academy of North Carolina in Greensboro. It'll be there on the MANC campus Friday, November 8th at 4 and 7 at Performance Hall, where Joel will be appearing throughout the day with master classes and outreach with the students and faculty. This will be followed by an evening concert and meet and greet. Joel Fan recently spoke with me by phone from his studio in New York. Really enjoying this Revelations recording. What was that mentorship dynamic like between you and Mr. Kirchner, and what was he like as a man, as a person?
Oh, he was really, for me, an incredible influence. Because he took such a deep personal interest in my development and what I was doing. yeah, I found him to be, you know, really a great mentor. And someone that I think of almost, you know, every day or every other day. You know, he could be abrasive at times. He could be very direct and harsh. But I found that he was very, you know, just a great influence.
What's a concept or a core element in that dynamic that sticks with you on a daily? You know, something that really stands out in that, you know, teacher-student relationship?
He was a great pianist himself. And he had a wonderful touch at the piano. And he, one of his concepts to a pianist was, you know, you never play beyond your own weight. You know, that was his own way of expressing how, you know, your own sound had to be individual to yourself. You know, not somebody else's, but your own.
How do you find that?
You know, I think you find that by a lot of practice and a lot of listening to other people. And then, you know, just learning how to relax. That's what it was for me, was learning that ultimately making music and having a really wonderfully expressive and fluid performance is all about just relaxing and you know, letting it flow. That's sort of the way I'd now explain it. You know, if I was a teacher, that's the way I'd explain it. You know, Kirshner, he explained it as not playing beyond his own weight. In terms of connections between notes, that's another example. You know, he'd always talk about the spaces, you know, between the notes, and not so much even the notes themselves, it's the spaces between them that give music all the meaning.
Were you studying composition as well as piano with Mr. Kirshner, or just piano?
You know, we did a little bit of composition because, you know, he had you know, obviously a wonderful composition studio, and we did some, you know, he asked me to write things. He had a very compositional approach to teaching music. He's like, you have to think of music like a composer. He would always say that.
That's unusual.
And yes, it is unusual, you know, to kind of, and again, it's because he was a composer, to be able to look at a piece of music and almost like an X-ray or an MRI, you know, tell you everything about the music and tell you what the composer's intentions were. And I think the idea was to understand the composer's intentions and then go from there to the meaning of the music and from there the interpretation that would best convey that meaning.
Hmm.
I think these are all things which were part of his approach. And having the deep compositional insight into the music, you know, would lead him to revelatory interpretations.
Hmm.
You know? And I think that's part of the uniqueness of that approach.
Yeah, that must have been quite something.
I'll give you an example. You know, he might have noticed a connection between one of the moments in a work and another one, maybe at the climax. And then the way you would, you know, possibly delay or pause or emphasize a certain note previous to the climax, you know, would then help, you know, accentuate that connection.
I could see that.
That might be a, you know, something that he would do.
Just turning to his musical output, Joel, I've always enjoyed the, at least, you know, I recall short piano works, hearing them on Classical 24, and always been kind of drawn to his music. From the performer's bench, and you performed so many of his works, how do you feel his music, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Well, I feel that his music is actually very sensual, and that's a word he himself would use. So you know, he wrote music in a time where more mathematical approaches were possibly more politically correct, and he believed in himself and in his own ethos that it was sensuality which was ultimately the mother of all of his music. So it ultimately had to make sense to the senses, to the emotions, but of course it always had the same, you know, intellectual rigor that he practiced in his compositions.
Yeah.
For me as a performer, definitely that's what I focus on is the emotion, the turbulence, the things that make a story. And I think that's ultimately what makes for great music is the storytelling.
Certainly think one of the great examples on this CD, Revelations, having heard The Forbidden, I was thinking that if I was a classically trained pianist, this is a piece that I would just love to play because it has just everything in it. What are you finding in that 9-minute piece of music?
I will say that piece and me have a little bit of a history because he actually wrote it for me. And so I was able to witness the birth of the piece and witness how he would manipulate the materials and even struggle with the composition of it and discover things. And he'd get so excited when he discovered something that worked in a particular moment of the piece. And he'd play it for me and he'd say, you know, ask me for my opinion. But it literally would take me almost, I'd say, 5 years to actually get to the root of interpretation that I felt really, really happy with. And that's the one on this recording. As a performer, this is a work which is, you know, I think of it as being Kirshner's very last work, you know, and the last work in a life that was very well lived. There's a tragic element to it. There's a moment of humanity at the end. I think of a journey through a lot of struggle and a lot of pain into one of understanding. And you even see a bit of heaven, you know, in the middle of it. Hmm. So I think of it also as comparable in a way to late Beethoven, the late Beethoven sonatas and what Beethoven is going for, the cosmicness, the universality of emotion. And Kirshner does that here in his own way.
I have to say, I'm really drawn. Your performance is just wonderful, and hearing it, I was drawn to the work not without that background, and it's fascinating to know that deep connection with the work. And then I read that it actually pays homage to or gives a nod to one of my very favorite books, Thomas Mann's Dr. Faustus. Did you ever have any discussions of along those lines, a literary connection there, and that fictitious composer?
Yes. That actually was also. Another reason why this work had such a deep meaning to Kirshner is he was really vamping in his mind on that idea of Dr. Faustus and the devil and, you know, what is the meaning of harmony and what is the meaning of 12-tone atonality and how do these two relate. In fact, that's the sort of the crux of his explanation of the forbidden being, you know, the forbidden harmonies, right? What was forbidden for a composer such as himself and him then exploring it. You know, as I perform, you know, the music to the audience, I find it to be a useful nugget of inspiration, but I use that as a starting point. And for me, it actually is about, you know, his conscience, Kirshner's conscience is encapsulated in this 9-minute work and all the far-ranging things that he would come up with.
For the non-musician, I should say that kind of a double meaning there, because I mean, forbidden harmonies, forbidden intervals, it dates back to pre-Renaissance, you know, certain intervals, certain harmonic motions were deemed intervals of the devil, and yet in a 21st century context, it seems even more interesting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because what happens, again, is political orthodoxy and sort of the wisdom of the crowd almost sometimes dictates what you can and cannot do. But that's life, and that's politics, and that's, unfortunately, there is some amount of that in the musical world and also in composition.
To point out for listeners, also on the recording, vocal selections, you're accompanying soprano Diana Hoagland and also a choir. What are some of the challenges in those contexts or rewards, if you will, singing in the vocal context and accompanying in those situations?
Well, I would say that I never thought of those parts as accompaniments. In fact, you know, for me, the playing with Diana and playing with the choir in that work called Dawn, you know, I definitely treated the piano as a solo partner to the singer and to the choir. And, you know, the piano itself has so much of the mood and the setting, you know, to these poems. And you know, Kirshner being, you know, a great virtuoso pianist himself, he would veer off into his own, you know, cadenzas, you know, in the middle of these works, which are very evocative. So,
it's been interesting this because I've had several friends recording with either Capriccio or Naxos or, you know, what have you, and I'm always struck by that recording dynamic. What makes it good versus great versus life-changing from the piano bench then? What do you need to hear? What is Reference Recordings bringing to your work that you really love?
Well, I feel very fortunate to have a relationship with Reference Recordings. You know, they are known as one of the premier audiophile labels around the world, actually. And as I tour around, I'll oftentimes have people say, wow, your stuff is on Reference. You know, I love all their stuff. So they're a smaller label, but they really concentrate on the very highest end of the audiophile market, you know, the people with the highest end equipment, the highest resolution speakers. And their intent is to really create the most truthful, yet inviting and lifelike experience from the performance.
Internationally renowned Steinway artist Joel Fan. On Friday night, November 8th at 4 o'clock and 7, Joel will be on the Music Academy of North Carolina campus throughout the day with master classes and outreach with the students and faculty there in Performance Hall. Then on Saturday night, November 9th at 7:30 at the Sloan Theater of Greensboro Day School, it's a fundraising concert for the Academy, followed by a reception and meet and greet. You'll find links to these events, Joel's recordings, and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find archived shows on our website, along with links to helpful upcoming performance information at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send us your thoughts as well. Our email is triadarts@wfu.edu. We leave you now with the dulcet guitar tones of Larry Davis. On Tuesday night, November 12th at 7 o'clock, Larry will show off his versatility at a memorial concert for his father, the late banjo player Glenn Davis, at Ashboro Sunset Theater. On the 22nd and 23rd, Larry will be at Roy's Craft Fair in Oak Hollow Mall in High Point. And December 23rd, look for Larry at the Biltmore Estate during Christmas at Biltmore. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.